Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Stephen Barton. Stephen was a top honor student at Syracuse University, and last May he was chosen among all the undergraduates to deliver the student commencement address. He was also awarded a Fulbright grant to teach English in Russia. But that's not the reason why he's here. As many of you may remember, Stephen was in the Theater 9 audience in Aurora, Colorado, the night that James Holmes went on his shooting spree, killing 12 people and wounding many others. Stephen was among those wounded and had to undergo emergency surgery on his neck and shoulder. Following this experience, he was recruited to join the advocacy group Mayors Against Illegal Guns as an outreach and policy associate. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know that you have told this story literally 1,000 times, but I'm wondering if we can begin with a brief rendition of your experience of the attack.
Yeah, well, I think what's most striking about, at least to me, what happened to me is how normal the night was before the shooting, before that event. I was in the middle of a cross-country bicycle trip with my best friend from home. And, you know, we rode into Aurora around 4 p.m. Earlier than we had expected. We knew a girl who lives there in Aurora, and she'd agreed to host us. So, you know, we went to the movies with her. You know, it couldn't have been more normal. And, I mean, my first memory of when things changed and when things became less than normal was when kind of a canister streaked across the screen, across the theater, and it was just emitting a lot of smoke. I found out later it was tear gas. And around that same moment when the canister landed, the firing began from the front right of the theater. And it was so dark that I just saw the muzzle of the gun. And I actually thought it was fireworks. I thought it was a prank being played to evacuate the theater and to ruin the night for everyone there. And, I mean, I was hit pretty early on. It was the shotgun, the first weapon that he used. And, you know, I brought my right arm up kind of at the last possible moment, and in that moment I was shot. So it was kind of – I was realizing what was happening as I was shot. And obviously once I was shot, you know, I realized fully what was going on and kind of the gravity of the situation. And, I mean, I just waited there. I mean, my recollection is very auditory. I never blacked out, but just because I was keeping my head down and kind of hiding behind the seats in front of me. And so I was just listening to people screaming, you know, to the chaos, but also, I mean, the very steady report of the AR-15, you know, the rifle that he had, and that just, you know, echoing off the walls. And, you know, mercifully, thankfully, that rifle jammed, his 100-round magazine jammed, and in that moment I was able to escape. I didn't realize that at the time. I heard the shooting stop and just bolted for the exit. And once I got out into the parking lot, I was able to meet up with some police officers, and they took me eventually to the emergency room, and I was in surgery pretty quickly.
And did you met up with the police pretty soon after you got outside? So they were there in your memory quickly then.
Yeah, it was a pretty rapid response time. I mean, by my recollection, it was probably 2 to 3 minutes from when the shooting started and when I was in the parking lot. But I've heard estimates as quick as 90 seconds between when it started and when they were on the scene.
I was wondering whether there are things about that evening that you didn't remember at first that you then recalled later or that you recalled more recently?
I think sometimes when I tell the story, I might, depending on who I'm talking to, emphasize certain parts of it as opposed to others. My biggest fear is that I won't, you know, the memory will become duller to me over time. And I don't want that to happen, actually. I think it's valuable in a way to remember what that's like. You know, it's just, I don't know, it certainly, among other things, it makes me value, you know, just the normalcy of life and life itself more than I did before. But, I mean, for a lot of reasons, I really hope that I don't ever forget anything from that night.
Have you ever written it all down, kept some kind of a journal?
I've never written it down in one, you know, one space, but I've written it, you know, details about the journey and about that night and that experience in different, you know, in different ways. But it certainly would be worthwhile to do that.
And are you now fully recovered physically from this?
I I guess you could put it around like 75% to 80%. The biggest lingering injury that I had, and this is just one of many reasons why I feel very lucky, is that all I had was some nerve damage in my left shoulder. So the shotgun pellets that were in my neck, they damaged, they missed my arteries, they missed, you know, all of that very important tissue, but they hit some nerves. And so right after the shooting, I couldn't even move my left arm at all. And now, I mean, I can lift it. I have a full range of motion pretty much, but a lot of the muscles are very weak. And so it's going to be a pretty long-term recovery. And there's some worries about maybe my rotator cuff wearing down or, you know, other things and monitoring for lead poisoning because of the pellets that are still in me. But, I mean, all things considered, I'm on my way back.
And what about the two people that were with you that night? How are they doing now?
Well, the friend that I was biking with, he wasn't physically wounded. I mean, he saw a lot of things that, you know, no one ever wants to see. But he's doing really well. And the girl who hosted us and who was actually sitting between the two of us, she was hit with a shotgun pellet in her head. And it actually traversed her brain to the back of her skull. And miraculously, it missed all of the vital areas of her brain. It essentially traveled through this, like, fluid-filled channel. And, you know, she had brain surgery. She had the whole nine yards. And now if you met her, I don't even think that you'd know she had been shot in the head. She's made a very strong recovery.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Stephen Barton, an outreach and policy associate with the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns and a survivor of the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. Now, you had this Fulbright grant, and you were getting ready to go when you were going to finish this cross-country trip on your bike, and you postponed it in part, as I understand it, to work to change gun policy in the United States.
The main reason for deferring the Fulbright was the nerve damage that I'd undergone. And I had basically decided that it probably wouldn't be great to be stuck in any country abroad, but, I mean, particularly Russia. I was just worried that, you know, if there were any complications, it was just too risky. And it took me forever to decide. You know, I was really back and forth. Like, I didn't want what had happened to me to change my life in any way more than it already had. But I eventually had to decide that, you know, it just didn't make sense. And the State Department was very understanding of all of this. And the way I actually got connected to Mayors Against Illegal Guns was through my senator, Senator Blumenthal. And he had met with my friend and me after the shooting, just, you know, as constituents, you know, talking to us and hearing about our experience. And, you know, it was a very thoughtful, you know, personable meeting. And at the end, he said, you know, what are you doing next year? And I told him I didn't have any plans. I just decided to defer this Fulbright. And he offered the help of his chief of staff to find me, you know, some opportunity. And after thinking about doing, you know, something related to Russia, I kind of, at the same time, I was reading more about gun violence and, you know, trying to put my experience in greater context. And just the more I read, the more upset I became. And I just decided eventually that I had to do something about it. I had to get involved. And so I ended up, through the help of Senator Blumenthal and his chief of staff, approaching them and approaching the New York City Mayor Bloomberg, his staff. And I came to them and I said, you know, I want to do anything and, you know, everything. I just want to help somehow. And they were able to offer me employment, full-time employment. I've been working there since mid-September.
That was going to be one of the other questions you just anticipated. So you, just to be clear for our listeners, you are an employee of the organization
That's
at this
correct.
Point. Okay.
Yeah.
And what is the focus of your activities for them?
Well, it's a few things. I mean, I do, you know, media appearances. I act as, you know, public advocate, like in this case, for our work and what we do. And kind of as a voice for other survivors and other victims that don't necessarily have the platform that I do. But beyond that, I mean, I work with the, you know, behind-the-scenes operations. So that's helping with communications and media in general, helping with research and policy stuff. And the third thing, and maybe the most important, is helping with outreach to other survivors and victims' family members.
Well, tell me more about that last part of that work then, doing that outreach. Is there a set of common issues that you encounter when you meet with these other folks, these other survivors?
Well, it really depends on the case. So people come at this issue when they're affected by gun violence in this way, you know, by losing a loved one or by getting shot themselves. Everyone comes at it in a different way. And so some people almost immediately want to start advocating and start working on this issue in the same way that I did. But some people could take months, it could take years even before they feel comfortable with talking about this. And so just talking about Newtown, you know, it's only been 2 months since that shooting. And there are already some families that we work with that just wanted to start talking about this issue almost from the second week. So I'm not sure what might make that this case unique. I think in some ways there's a feeling that this time is different than any one before. And so there's a particular urgency that even the family members feel themselves about kind of this window of time in which their voices are extremely powerful and extremely important. But, you know, we just try to be very considerate and very, you know, give people space and present the opportunities to them, but we never, you know, compel them to do anything. It's more letting them come at this at their own level of comfort.
Before I ask you this next question, I just want to say at the outset that I don't mean any disrespect with this, or I don't mean to discount the power of your own personal experience here. But, of course, being the survivor of a shooting doesn't make you an expert on gun policy. So is this something you feel like you're learning along the way as you go? And can you tell me a bit about that process?
Yeah, certainly. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's something that I've had to, you know, come to terms with, because I think right after an event like this happens to someone, it's kind of natural to feel, you know, people must listen to me. You know, I've been through this horribly traumatic event. Like, you know, my opinion must have some value. And it does to some extent. But, you know, I realized very early on that I could only be a powerful advocate if I did have the backing of, you know, the research, the policy, the expertise that other people have. And so I've been working very hard to kind of learn all of that. And so that I can kind of deliver the emotional side of this issue, but beyond that, you know, back it up with facts and figures that make my argument a more compelling one. But certainly it's been an ongoing process. I mean, I'm always learning. And there's always more to learn about this issue, as with any other issue. Yeah.
And I imagine that both emotionally and at a deeper psychological level, serving in this capacity has got to be a quite complicated thing for you and for the people who encounter you. I'm imagining that people project a lot of things onto you and you're seen in different ways by different people. Could you reflect a little bit on how that has been for you?
Yeah, I mean, at least personally for me, it's been kind of a therapeutic positive process. You know, it's been a way for me to process what happened to me. And deal with what happened to me and basically turn it into something that's empowering. But, yeah, it's certainly right. I mean, there are all sorts of people, and when it comes to, you know, the people I encounter who are opposed to my efforts and the efforts of the organization I work for. And some of those people are what could best be described as, you know, just regular gun owners who have valid concerns about, you know, the government and what the government is going to do with their guns. Sometimes they're misinformed, but they have these concerns. And I enjoy talking to people like that and you know, talking through their concerns and what they believe. But other times, I mean, on the other side of the spectrum, you have people who could be described as conspiracy theorists, you know, who believe that in some cases that I'm a paid actor, that you know, my experience didn't actually happen. You know, Sandy Hook never happened. Aurora never happened. That these were government inside jobs. You know, there's a whole spectrum of people that I deal with on a daily basis. And I don't really pay too much heed to, obviously, the latter group. But, yeah, it's kind of difficult to negotiate that space sometimes, because I don't know what people in some cases are going to project on me, and whether, you know, whether they just disagree with me or whether they completely distrust me as an individual, you know, right off the bat. So it can be tricky sometimes.
A few weeks ago, I was talking to someone who worked with returning wounded war veterans, and she was describing one of the things that the soldiers said to her about after they were back home, that they oftentimes felt like they needed to be able to tell the person that was talking to them that things were okay, that that person was looking to them to make them feel okay about all of this. Do you ever get that?
Not too much, but I think sometimes people might assume certain things about my experience and kind of how I feel now. I mean, often people, for example, when I'm talking to them, they'll say kind of as you did, you know, like, I know you've told your story so many times, but, you know, would you mind saying it again? And I actually, you know, I don't feel any problem at all talking about that. And that I think is unexpected for some people. And that's just one example. But I don't know. I think I've had a better experience with this and have been able to process this better than I think most people expect.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Stephen Barton. It seems like to me there are at least two conversations now going on about guns, and different sides are pointing out the relevant differences between the two to try to make their bigger points about gun control. On the one hand, you have the experience that you were part of, very dramatic, a mass shooting by a crazed killer who's heavily armed. And then on the other hand, there is this more day-to-day gun violence, a lot of it in poor city neighborhoods related to gangs using illegal handguns. So what might help to prevent the James Holmeses of the world from being able to act might not be what lowers the murder rate, say, in the city of Syracuse. Mm-hmm. So how do you see the relationship between those two conversations and the sets of debates that they each generate?
Well, that's a really good question, and that kind of speaks to kind of the conflict here at play in this conversation, because these mass tragedies are the only events that kind of cause the public to care about this issue in a big way. And, you know, nobody or few people are aware of the fact that, you know, over 30 Americans are being murdered with guns every single day, you know, more than were killed in Sandy Hook. That's happening on a daily basis, and not even including suicides, which is another, you know, ignored issue in this or ignored component of this issue. But that, I mean, this is the issue, that people often only pay attention to Sandy Hook or to Aurora or to Oak Creek or Tucson or Virginia Tech. But as you said, the solutions that might address that won't necessarily address the day-to-day violence. And I think it's important to look at both. But the reality is, you know, what happened to me is exceedingly rare and you know, just doesn't happen. I mean, even though it's becoming less and less rare, it's still a pretty rare event. But the gun violence that happens in our cities and not just in our cities, in all sorts of communities across the country, that is happening on a daily basis. And there are ways that we can prevent that and that we know will work. And that is what I see as the important part of the debate right now.
And this is such a powerful topic for the media, obviously. It combines an important news and policy issue with something where the sensationalism of the kind of attack you experience is just simply irresistible for them. So what have you learned about the media from all this experience?
That's you know, I would say I've learned – if I've learned anything, it's been just how the media works in this whole experience and, you know, how it's true, you know, they are very sensationalist, and I already understood that on some level, but to see it firsthand, you know, to see that, to understand that people are in the media only care about you, or they're only listening to you because, you know, you went through this horrible event. You kind of have to understand that, because as someone in my shoes, because it's easy to just kind of inflate your own self-worth and be like, oh, well, people care about what I'm saying. And in some cases, that's true, but in many cases, it's just I was the kid who was in the theater. I got shot and I survived. You know, that sometimes is it. And I'm not saying that's the case here. I'm just saying that that is sometimes how it comes off. And that's something that I've kind of had to adjust to.
And that sort of leads to the last thing I wanted to ask you before we get to the three questions at the end. I was wondering if you could look forward and reflect on the following. The event in Colorado is going to be part of your bio for the rest of your life. Do you see this event as something that's going to define you in some important ways? How do you expect that it's going to influence you down the road?
I hope that it doesn't define me. I hope that whatever does define me, if anything does down the road, that it's something that, you know, I created or built out of my own, you know, skill or ambition, as opposed to, you know, something that just happened to me. Even if it were, you know, how I turned around what happened to me into this, you know, advocacy work. At the same time, I still don't hope that is, you know, the defining moment of my life. But I have to say, I mean, this is something that I'll be talking about, whether in a professional or volunteer capacity, for the rest of my life, you know, until I'm hopefully an old man. You know, this is not something that will disappear, certainly not in the next year. So it's something that I will always care about very deeply, and that I will always be working to change.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I'll go for a simple title, just, you know, transition. I feel in many ways that this year has been just this transition between college and something, you know, just two very sure things, which were college and what I thought was sure, this Fulbright scholarship, which I still plan to undertake next year. I guess just transition.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I would say procrastination. That is, I still haven't shaken that habit, despite being out of college.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think just, you know, talking to the media, you know, as I am now, like just being thrown into this very public spotlight, but still being able to advocate in what I hope is a powerful way, and just feeling very much at ease, more at ease than I ever expected to be, whether it's live TV on radio or talking to a journalist on the phone.
That was Stephen Barton. Stephen, thanks so much for talking with me, and it's good to see you doing well.
Good to see you too. Thanks.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.